Hello, and welcome to another episode of the IT News Podcast. On the show this week, we have Executive Director of Digital Government for the Northern Territory, Ewan Perrin, talking about digital transformation in the top end. Perrin spoke to IT News as part of the 2021 State of the IT Report, which assesses how Australia's states and territories are travelling with digital government. Please enjoy. Thanks for joining us to discuss the NT's digital government progress as part of the IT News State of IT Report. The last couple of years have seen some pretty big changes from what I can see in the NT government's approach to digital transformation. And much of this appears to have been prompted, I guess, by the 2019 Plan for Budget Repair, which highlighted the opportunities that digital presented and recommended that a digital-first service mindset be adopted by the government. How important was this budget repair plan, and was it the kickstart the NT government needed?
Thanks for having me, Justin. The plan for budget repair arose out of a review of the territory government's financial situation, which at the time turned out was pretty dire. So we really had a financial and a cost optimisation focus. The government's digital transformation efforts really kicked off the year before in 2018 with the launch of the Digital Territory Strategy, which was the Northern Territory's first first digital territory strategy. And so from there, each year we've established a digital territory action plan, which basically takes the overarching strategy and brings it to life. And actually that's what's been really driving our digital transformation since then.
Yeah, that's obviously, you've had various iterations of that as you've gone along, and I'll get to that a little bit later on. But yeah, as part of this budget repair plan, there were quite a few, I guess, changes to the structure of IT and the way you did things. And one of those was centralizing digital services within the now Department of Corporate and Digital Development. And this didn't seem, as far as I could recall, as one of the real recommendations of the report. So I guess, what has the impact of this decision been, and has it led to improved coordination in IT projects, things like fewer cost overruns or delays, for example?
Yeah, look, the centralisation has been a massive structural change to the way that we deliver our digital services and actually our corporate services as well. And that applies all the way across Northern Territory government. Over the past 2 years, we've actually consolidated most of our services and applications centrally now, and the positive impacts that we can already see are more consistent delivery of services and I guess a more standardized treatment of the way we interact with our agencies. It includes, like, we're giving better support to agencies that might have been underserviced in the past because they weren't aware of what services were available. But it gives us better visibility of our assets and about people and the way that the roles have been split formally across different agencies. So a couple of things there. It gives better career path visibility and more opportunities for our people. And it gives us, now that we have a better handle on what our technology assets are, our digital assets are, we're able to make better investment decisions as a result as well. Mm. And that includes things like even decisions about where we can see duplication might have occurred in the past, we can avoid costs of doing something more than once because we can see it all in one place. And I think the other thing is we're seeing some hard financial benefits in our agency as we start returning savings to government over the next few years. But because it's a whole of government initiative, you'll see that there's, I guess there'll be pockets of benefit across all parts of the government as well.
What's the size of the IT team within the department? How many people are we looking at?
It varies, of course. We've got about just over 400, I think, permanent employees, but some of the major projects that we have underway, we have quite a number of contractors in those as well. I think we've got about 300 to 400 people working on projects at any one time as well.
And that's things like the big health overhaul that's going on at the moment and things like that.
Yes, the health overhaul, overhaul of policing systems, child protection and safety systems, and a few others as well.
One of the interesting things I found with the centralization of IT services was that you've done away with CIOs and agencies and moved them within the department. And this is, I guess, quite unlike how, you know, most other state and territory governments sort of approach IT. And it also means you, I guess, you wear a lot of hats, or at least one very big hat. Can you explain, you know, how this all works?
Sure. It was a multi-step approach that we took, because as you can imagine, bringing all of the agencies and all the agency CIOs into one department is going to have, there'll be some growing pains, I guess. But so the first thing we did was we moved the agency staff and the CIOs into that central construct, but we left them pretty much intact in terms of the way they delivered their services and the agencies that they interacted with. During that time, we were able to then standardize the services, start to aggregate some of the services, including some of our technical services and technical teams and so on. And so now we have a much smaller, I think we have four agency-facing teams, as well as separate technical services area and data services area. Now, each of those teams is headed by, I guess, what was the old agency CIOs, the CIO equivalents. And they all report to our Deputy Chief Executive of Digital Services on the operations side. The strategy, policy and assurance side reports to me as the head of digital government. And I managed to get the title of whole of government CIO, but the reality is I'm doing less of the operations and the service delivery and more on the strategy and policy side. So I work very closely with our Deputy CE Digital. We line strategy and delivery across the whole portfolio together.
And now that you've got, I guess, structure fully sorted, how is the government progressing with the recommendations that were made under the plan more generally, things like the IT systems stocktake and the digital government transformation plan?
Yeah, I think there were seven recommendations for digital under that plan, plan for budget repair. The ICT system stocktake is actually complete, and the digital government transformation plan is still being finalised. It's our expectation that we'll get cabinet endorsement of that plan by the end of the year. That plan is going to show us that a roadmap to digital government transformation that sort of spans the next 5 years. It'll outline what our priorities are and what our approach is to getting there as well. It's actually a fundamental document that will. That will actually help the government to sort of surge forward in terms of its digital transformation agenda.
And how does that compare with, say, the digital strategy that you've had since 2018 and have been updating on a yearly basis?
Yeah, so the digital territory strategy is a territory-wide document. It actually goes beyond just government. Certainly, there's a theme in there of improving government services, but it's also about growing jobs and connecting our communities and building skills and those other things as well. So it's a much broader strategic sort of framework. Mm. This particular plan is really about what are we going to do in government to improve delivery of services to our citizens and to our businesses? What technology are we going to use to change internally the way that we deliver our services? How can we streamline and automate a lot of those services?
I guess it'll connect quite strongly with the stock take that you've already completed. Can you give us some insight as to the kinds of things that the stock take, raised, and you know, how many systems are there across government at present, and how many of these do you expect will be rationalised over the course of the 5-year plan?
That ICT systems stock take that was a prerequisite really to the government transformation plan. We needed to understand our current state, what we actually had, before we could figure out what to rationalise and how to do it and what our roadmap to the future might be. So we initially identified over 1,000 systems, and I say systems in inverted commas, because we quickly realised that we needed to have a much more nuanced way to describe what a system was, and also to understand what attributes were important for us to capture in an investment or in a rationalization sense. You know, we were capturing things like system age. The system age isn't actually very useful when you're deciding whether or not to continue to invest in it. It's more about, is the product still supported? Is it on a sustainable platform? How long since it was last upgraded? How many people does it affect? That sort of thing. Mm. So after doing a bit of massaging around what we decided was and was not a system, we ended up with about just over 600. And from that, we actually went in and sort of looked at how much duplication, or how much how many times have we replicated these things across different parts of government. And surprisingly, there wasn't too much. We had a few too many ticketing systems, a few CRM instances and other customer engagement sort of apps. And we'd had a lot of, I guess, different flavors or different versions and instances of platforms like SharePoint and those sorts of things that we were able to sort of do some consolidation there. But there were no big ticket items, I guess. And so that showed us that we were actually running fairly efficiently already. But what the IT Stocktake was able to provide us was it gave us the information that we could then feed into our technology investment planning and our transformation planning and our architecture discussions, so that we can make sure that our future investments take into account what we've already got. And again, it's a bit of a cost avoidance approach. We're less likely to invest in something that we've already got somewhere because we can see it.
Yeah, it's interesting you mention investments. You know, one of the things I was interested in hearing about is how you're using this reform as a way to, I guess, change the traditional approach to IT funding and the greater use of OPEX and things like that. And, you know, using this Stocktake as a means to increase the use of cloud across government, whether that's public, private, or a variation of those two.
It's a good question. We've already sort of highlighted that the government is resource constraint, I suppose, is the easy way to put it. So there's not a lot of capital, there's not a lot of OPEX either actually to go around. So every time we make an investment decision, or every time we decide whether or not to fund a project, we really need to look at what is the benefit going to be, what are the risks, and is it the most important thing to do? Because we have to do a lot of extreme prioritization. When it comes to cloud, we have a cloud policy, but we don't have a cloud only or cloud first sort of approach. We're really taking an adaptive approach, which is to say that we'll take a pick each time as to what's actually going to make the most sense for us. And sometimes it's private, sometimes it's public, sometimes it's a mix.
One of the other interesting things I wanted to sort of understand was what's happened since COVID emerged over the last sort of 18 months. How did COVID impact the government's transformation? Did it change anything significantly, including those recommendations in the budget repair plan? And then, you know, was it forced to delay anything significantly, or to focus on those short-term needs?
Yeah, I think COVID delayed everybody's plans across the country, probably across the world, I guess. So I think the planning that we were doing around digital transformation was certainly affected, because we had to respond to the immediate threat. But we did see that even though we were going to delay some of those bigger plans, there was an opportunity for us to accelerate some aspects of digital take-up. You know, so we were able to embed work from home capability very quickly because we had to. The pace that we did some development of some of our public health and COVID-related apps, it's not sustainable, but it was super fast, and we could do that sort of stuff very quickly. So I guess we had to slow down some of the longer term stuff, but at the same time we could accelerate some of the things that just had to be done. We can leverage some of that, the learnings from that, in some of our other more recent or more contemporary work that we're doing.
Were there any practices that you sort of adopted on the fly as a result of the pandemic that have, I guess, continued or you know, the department still uses now, and that's, I guess, something that's changed as a result of the pandemic? You know, what are the kinds of things that have been adopted since then?
If you go back to what the department looked like a couple of years ago, we had to, because of the amount of change that we were going through, through that sort of centralization and consolidation, by necessity, we had a lot of governance. We had a lot of committees, we had a lot of governance and so on. And if we fast forward to what happened when COVID sort of really took over, we didn't have the time to spend doing that. So we had to lean up our governance a little bit. And so we rationalized our committees and so on. And I think some of the practices that we've continued since this time last year has been, we still have those committees, we still have those governance arrangements, but we every meeting, every discussion, every set of papers is very, very sharply focused. We don't have the time to spend too much time, I guess, ruminating and umming and ahhing and toing and froing. So all of our conversations are very focused, and they're all focused on what's the benefit of this, what's going to be the benefit to the territory, what's the benefit to our citizens, and so on. So I think they're good practices that we've managed to really embed.
And what were some of the solutions? I mean, I've read about one called a suite of tools called C19C. What are some of the other solutions that, you know, the department introduced since sort of February, May last year?
We call it C19C. That's because it's COVID-19, basically. COVID-19 compliance is where the acronym came from. That app or that suite, if you like, covered a range of functions: contact tracing, border controls, health information management, those sorts of things. And as I said before, we sort of developed a lot of these things in record time. We had a whole lot of people who really didn't sleep over those first few weeks, sort of March, April, May last year. And they just sort of churned this stuff out, and it really hung together really well. And it was quite a complex assembly of platforms, capabilities, applications, APIs, data structures, and so on. So again, going back to what you were saying before about the things that we had to delay some of our formal enterprise architecture development and some of the things that were going down there, because the architecture in this case had to evolve very quickly out of that C19C suite. Mm. But what we found, because we had some very smart people working on it, we were able to reuse those patterns for other similar functions that we used when we designed smart forms and APIs and those sorts of things. We also adapted the ACT's check-in app. So we now have our own territory check-in app, but it's based on the ACT's one. And so we're starting to build a suite of applications sort of around that. And it's quite a robust architecture, and nothing's future-proof, but we can see quite a long future ahead for some of those things as well. And so I guess, as I was saying before, we were able to really leverage that emergency situation, and we can actually take these things and not use them just as a point solution, but sort of roll them into our strategic solutions.
I'd like to move to the Digital Territory Action Plan that you mentioned earlier, and I guess the broader digital strategy that you mentioned. I see that was just very recently updated, as I think maybe earlier this month or late last month. What are some of the key projects on the agenda for the coming year?
Yeah, so our Digital Territory website has just been revamped, and we did launch it about a week ago. And that has that Digital Territory Action Plan for 21-22. There's actually 57 specific initiatives in the plan, so there's quite a lot going on there. Some of them are ongoing ones that have been happening for a while, and some of them are large multi-year projects. And then we've also identified quite a few new projects as well. I guess some of the big ticket items there is our digital health system that's been going for a couple of years now. That's actually replacing all of our NT Health major systems and integrating all of our a large range of our specialist clinical systems as well. It's basically going to become an electronic record. It will cover every patient in the territory, and it supports every health service as well. So it's quite leading edge in terms of digital health for our territory. And it's the first time we've really managed to get patient administration, emergency triage, operating theatres, maternity, health centres, all rolled into the one patient record. So that's a really big one. We've got a few other big ones. We're upgrading our integrated policing system. Again, a multi-year project, which should be complete in the next 12 to 18 months as well. That'll contemporize our policing system. The other big one that is a multi-year one, it's called CARE, and it's actually a child protection and youth justice integrated system that's really looking at child safety. I guess the innovation, if you like, on that, or the big challenge that we're overcoming with that is that we're integrating data that's held in our child protection, our housing, our policing, our courts and correction systems, and other systems and health systems, all to have the child at the centre for the protection of the child. And it's taken a lot of effort to get there. And that's another one that we're hoping to release in the next 12 to 15 months as well.
And a lot of those three major projects that you mentioned, they would, I guess, go to replacing a lot of those legacy systems that you mentioned before were identified through the IT system stock take?
Yes, that's right. Some of them were. And I think when we started with that number of 1,000 and got down to 600, some of those we managed to aggregate under these things as well. So we're already sort of shrinking them down that way.
One of the items that I noticed and I was quite interested by was that you've started investigating digital identity solutions and you know, how they can be used by citizens to access government online services. It's obviously on the agenda for all state and territory governments at the moment. How progressed is this work?
This is something that I think is fundamental. Digital identity is fundamental to achieving a personalized citizen experience or a business experience. We need digital identity before we can join up our services, streamline our interactions, and automate a lot of our processes and so on. So I think it's fundamental. The work is progressing. Now we've got we're actively exploring how we might design a digital identity system or exchange or set of capabilities for the territory, and obviously through our work with the national committees and the national ministers groups and so forth, we're looking at how that's going to integrate into the trusted digital identity framework as well, so that we can actually, I guess, get onto that national identity scheme as well. So it's super important. We've really kicked off the work now. And again, now that we probably would have done it 6 months earlier, but for some of the interruptions we've had, and I'm hoping to see, we'll see some real results in the next 12 months.
So it's sort of still in the discovery stage. It hasn't really progressed to, I guess, any trials or anything like that?
No, not quite. We've got a consultancy at the moment who's giving us some advice on some of the tools and platforms that we currently have to let us know whether or not they're going to be fit for purpose into the future. So we probably end up modernizing some of that. But at the same time, the systems that we're building now are designed so that they will plug into an identity, either an identity interface or some kind of portal like that as well.
What about the government's progress with online services more broadly? Is there a portal that citizens can go to access services? And I guess how many of these services are available online?
I guess we would say we're still starting that journey around online service portals. We do have the CanDo Territory portal, which was the start of that. That came out about 9 months ago now. And its focus was on, as part of our territory economic reconstruction work, its focus was on kickstarting business. So what we wanted to do was make it easy for people to do business here, to start a business, to renew their licenses, and so forth. So we've started to consolidate our services through there. So you can renew a liquor license, you can start a retail business, you can get your wastewater approvals online. And again, some of the patterns that we identified during that C19 suite of tools are the same ones that we're using now. And it's very simple things like, you know, if you accept something here, we'll send an SMS to you so that you know the status of your thing. So we're starting to track your application for business, that sort of thing. So we're just starting that process now. The citizen stuff is going to follow very quickly. We recognize that. But as I said, we really need to have identity in place before we can do that properly. The other things that we're maturing are our data management and data standards capability and data sharing, and some of the orchestration that we need to do across some of the back end or legacy systems that to be honest, don't neatly integrate yet and probably never going to neatly integrate. So we need to do a lot of things under the covers as well as the things on the surface too.
But when you get to, I guess, the point of having those online services, is the intention that you'll have a single government website or one-stop shop like a lot of the other states have now stood up?
It probably won't be exactly like what the other states have stood up because of the nature of our demographics. We've got 30% of our people live remotely, like very remotely, and don't all have access to digital services. 30% of our population is Indigenous. We have a lot of transients, fly-in, fly-out workers, grey nomads and so forth, backpackers and so on. Well, not so many backpackers at the moment.
Yeah.
So we have a really different demographic to what you might have in some of the more populous and more condensed states. So we need to make sure that we have analog or in-person services and front counter style services continue to be available. And so digital services, at least initially, are going to just augment that. And so while we might not have a single website or a one-stop shop, there'll be a front door and there's really no wrong door. And once you click in, we can get you to the place that you need to get to fairly quickly.
One other item that I found interesting on the action plan was the online cybersecurity training for government staff. Why is this being introduced? And was it in response to anything? And will it be the first time that such training is offered, I guess, government wide?
Cybersecurity is so pervasive, and cyber is such a threat these days. We recognise that the face-to-face delivery mode that we were using before wasn't going to get us across enough people quickly enough, firstly. Secondly, it doesn't provide a standardised enough set of messages. So we found some really good online security training packages that were available that actually met our needs and allowed us to tailor some of our messages and to launch sort of targeted campaigns as well. We now have that, and we can obviously push it out to everybody all at once. And so if there is an incident or if there is some sort of threat that we're concerned about, we can go out there very quickly and say, do this training. You know, we can sort of mandate the training to be done fairly quickly. I think the other thing I wanted to add to that is that we do cyber training and cyber security awareness for outside of government as well. So we're doing it. We're one of the few governments that actually goes and does it for our community as well. So we'll run cybersecurity awareness programs for our seniors, for our Indigenous, for business and so on as well. And we offer that as part of our services as well, because we recognise that cyber is a bit of a continuum. It's not just once you're inside the government bubble, you're safe, because we're obviously interacting with our community all the time as well.
And then how else is the government working to address cybersecurity concerns? A few years ago, there was some funding for a government cybersecurity center, a cyber operations center. Is this up and running at the moment?
We do have cyber operations. We don't have a physical center or a space that you would call a CSOC, but we obviously do. We do all our security operations and network monitoring and those sorts of things. So we've got a cyber security operational team, and we've got a cyber strategy team as well. Both of those teams don't like people talking about it. Because we don't want to let everybody know what we're up to, but I can assure you that we adhere to the Essential Eight sort of approach to cyber controls and cyber risk management, cyber threat management. We've also just recently opened a joint cybersecurity centre with ACSC, based up here in Darwin. That's partly awareness raising and resource sharing, so that it keeps us in close contact to ACSC in Canberra and our interstate colleagues as well, because with a fairly small population and being fairly remote up here, it's hard to attract and retain groups of cybersecurity specialists. So we like to stay as closely plugged into what's happening at the national level as we can.
Yeah, you mentioned the Essential Eight. Obviously, agencies across different levels of government struggled with those, as you know, they change constantly. How is the new NT government tracking with that? Is there mostly compliance, or is there still quite a way to go there, or is that something you can't talk about?
Yeah, look, it's something that we can't be specific about, and we wouldn't compare ourselves to other governments either, because I know different governments have different challenges. We're in a good situation because the majority of our network is a single network. We've only got a single email domain for all of the standard NT government, with a couple of minor exceptions. So it's easier to harden our perimeter, and it's easier to manage threats and to manage traffic and so on. So in that sense, I think we're probably in a less complex state than some of the larger state governments or the federal government. But and every business is a target. So we just continue to be as hygienic as possible and to be as cautious as possible in the way that we implement those things.
Finally, I wanted to touch on skills. And you mentioned that just before, I guess, with cyber security, how it's been difficult to get those personnel. it's something that's been traditionally a problem for the NT and, you know, poaching IT talent from, I guess, other states, the southern states particularly. How is the state working to, I guess, attract IT talent and develop in-house skills? And, you know, are there any programs that you've set up? And finally, what is the reliance on contractors like across government?
Yeah, I'd love to be a state because we'd have 10 extra senators that would be able to advocate on our behalf. But but yes, I understand. So just being facetious, we are a territory. And so that's actually, this part of our problem is that we are small jurisdiction where we're fairly remote. So it is difficult to attract talent. We've already started to attract a few, I guess you call them COVID refugees from the southern states. We're just starting the beginning of our wet season, or our build up at least to the wet season now. So it'll be interesting to see how many of them are still here in 6 months' time. We do a lot around graduate recruitment. So we've got a graduate recruitment program across government and in our agency as well. We're just kicking off an ICT traineeship program to pick up kids coming out of high school as well, or people who are doing vocational training as well, so that we're trying to pick them up early, have them working with industry, but also give them a stint inside of government so that they can see what it's like to be on both sides of that fence, and then see if we can find a slot for them there. Some of the other stuff that we do, we've got an RFQ or a tender out at the market at the moment, looking for some consulting services around digital industry capability assessment, because we want to get a much better understanding of what the gaps are in our current industry maturity, capability maturity. And I know some of that is going to be around skills gaps. So we're doing a lot of work there. We also work with tertiary sector, so Charles Darwin University in particular, where we sponsor, particularly around cyber, we sponsor a professorship who runs sort of a graduate and master's level cybersecurity courses. And we do a lot of other work with CDU on creating opportunities for women and girls in the digital sector, sponsoring events like the IT Code Fair, which is kind of like a hackathon kind of thing, and a whole lot of other events and things like that as well.
That was Ewan Perrin, the Executive Director of Digital Government for the Northern Territory. And that's the podcast for this week. We'll be back with an exciting new interview next week. Until then, you can check out the State of IT report and catch all the latest headlines in Australian IT over at itnews.com.au.